Welcome to the No Shame Podcast. This is John Groters. This is where we explore conversations with interesting and influential people right at the intersection of faith and culture. And today we welcome one of the greatest American hockey players of all time, NHL Hall of Fame goaltender John Van Beesbrouck. Welcome to No Shame Radio. This is John Groters. I'm kind of in awe this afternoon because a guy that I watched play hockey for many years has walked right into our building. John Van Beesbrouck, welcome to the No Shame Podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
It's only recently that I even learned you were in Michigan and you were just up the road in Muskegon. That was interesting to me, but we'll get there. I love the podcast format because for a while now we can breathe. This isn't a soundbite medium. This is a deeper medium. And for any of you in the podcast world who are fans of hockey, you might know the name John Van Beesbrouck. You have played in Olympics. You have played in All-Star games. You have made the Hall of Fame. You have won the Vezina Trophy as the best goaltender in the NHL. There's not a whole lot left, although I don't know, you didn't ever win the Stanley Cup. Is that right? You made it there, but...
Knocked on the door.
So I guess I would say there's one thing left.
Yeah.
But so we have with us today, a player who's seen every level of hockey. And I'm interested in hockey because I love the game and I love to watch it. But let's just get to know you a little bit. I mean, tell us what your life was like pre-NHL and where you grew up and what your story was.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in Detroit, Michigan. And it was an interesting place to grow up in the 60s through the 70s. A lot of racial tension at that time, but we didn't really encounter too much of that. I mean, we were a blue-collar family. My dad was a bricklayer, and my mom was she just found odd jobs to do. And she was from Italy. My dad was from Belgium, so they united by watching I Love Lucy and trying to learn how to speak English. So that was we didn't speak Italian. We didn't speak what was known as Flemish, the Belgian version of French, I guess. But it was fun. I mean, I had two brothers, both loved sports, and hockey became interesting because my oldest brother Frank. He was in tune with Sports Illustrated. Sports Illustrated at the time was really the coolest magazine going for a sports enthusiast. And when they had masks of goalies on the front cover, he wanted to be the coolest hockey player there was. And I was just trying to follow in his footsteps and follow what a brother did. But we played, when winter turned, we played in the backyard of a family down the street outdoor. And when it turned back to summer, we played ball and just had fun playing whatever sport you can with a stick, a puck, or a ball, or whatever we could find. And back in the days when you could play sandlot, just pick up games and during all, you ride your bike to the park. That's what I grew up. I grew up in a pretty blue-collar, safe environment.
Now, the goaltender doesn't get to score the goals. Is that right?
No. He's preventing them.
So how does anyone ever talk you into becoming the one position on the ice that's never going to score a goal?
That's a good question, because I don't believe somebody talks you into it. Mm. It's like similar being a catcher in baseball. Mm-hmm. It's like put on the stuff and, go back there and take a beating. But – hockey and goaltending, it's as you watch it today, it's the most challenging position maybe in sport. Mm. You're wearing all the equipment. All of that was really cool to me. I think that most of the time that I was thinking about playing a position, I wanted to play the best positions in the sport, ones that were really fun. So today we'd talk about quarterback or maybe shortstop in baseball. Mm-hmm. They were the positions that you could influence the game on, and I just wanted to be in the middle of the game. I just had fun playing sports.
Now, your brother, he was an influence. Was he also a goaltender?
He was, yeah. He's a great influence. He was quite good.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, back in the 70s, American-born players weren't really setting the world on fire, but then we had something in 1980 that happened in our country that kind of changed all that.
By the name of Jim Craig, he kept the puck out of the net. Yeah, were you watching that?
The Miracle on Ice. Yeah. I mean, it's I don't think it's talked about nearly enough. I know that it was portrayed in a movie, and those guys did a wonderful job. But the impact it had on young American players like myself was just really something to grab a hold of in a sport that was really relatively regionalized in our country. And fortunately, there was a longstanding tradition in Detroit.
You know, we're on the No Shame podcast with John Van Beesbrouck, and we're about the same age, I think, and so we remember that 1980 Lake Placid Olympics, but maybe some people don't. Just for context, put in your own words the odds of that U.S. team coming up against that Soviet team. How would you describe that?
Well, it's 1,000-to-1 uh-huh. type thing, and, you know, at the time, the nuance to this explanation is pro versus amateur. Mm-hmm. That's the best way to describe it is the Russians were all pros. They were men. Our players in the United States all came through college, and they were all college players taking a year off college, getting together to come together as a group. But we were just young guys that were, you know, finding their way, enjoying it. But very few players came out of college to play pros. It's mm-hmm. so different today. In the NHL, you see a 30% ratio of guys coming from schools and playing. And that's where the biggest growth has come. But the best way I can describe it is amateurs versus pros.
So you were in high school.
I was.
At the time.
Yep.
And were you playing Little Caesars? Or where were you playing hockey?
That's exactly where I was playing. I was playing for Little Caesars and played with a few of the Illich boys, and we had good teams, but at that time I was a 16-year-old player playing for a good team, and we were going to different places in Canada and all throughout the country just to be looked at, and it's known as our highest performance level at, you know, playing for Little Caesars or one of the club teams like that. In Detroit, Little Caesars is probably the most recognized name.
Mm-hmm. They would beat us pretty bad on the west side of the state when we run up against them. Now, I read a funny story about you. Anybody can research Wikipedia, but so I don't know if it's true or not. But you talk about when you were young. I read a story about how you had a game where there were scouts watching and you had a good game and you were wearing somebody else's jersey. Is that a true story? Can you tell me that?
That is a true story. It was actually on the team that we were just talking about, Little Caesars, and we had gone to a tournament in Canada. And Mike, his dad was the manager. And he had forgotten my jersey. So he said, you wear my son's jersey. I did, played well. At that time, at that age, when you're 16, that's where you're mostly scouted and recruited. But on the Canadian side of the fence, they have a draft. And I had played good in this tournament and this team in Toronto at that time, known as the Marlies. It's a little different today. They drafted this goalie named Mike Affolder in the fourth round, thinking it was me. And the general manager in Sault Ste. Marie, his name is McMaster, he picked up on it because my name is kind of long and it has every vowel in it, so you couldn't really forget it. And he called my mom and invited me to camp. And I ended up going there, making the team, which was – for an American to go up to Canada to make a team on an invite was unheard of, and the rest is history.
How did you feel when you found out your teammate got taken in the fourth round of Toronto? What was your reaction?
You know, I didn't know that part of the story until after. So I didn't know. I didn't follow the draft. I didn't follow any of that stuff. You're just a kid. I was playing baseball, and I heard about it. And but when I heard that part of the story after, I couldn't help but tell it.
That might be a scene in a movie we write soon, because that sounds really sinister to me. I don't think it maybe it was intentionally, but it could be portrayed to be quite sinister. So how did you make it from Sault Ste. Marie, and what was your dream? How hard did you work, and how did the ascent work for you?
Well, it happened pretty quickly. After I made this team, from an unusual standpoint as a walk-on, so to speak, had a really good year. Played a lot of the games, and the team did well, and I was in that age group where you're going to turn 18, and that's the NHL draft. And you know, we had gone to the semifinals, lost out, but I had won 40 games that year. And you know, you win 40 games in a season, and you're only playing 62 at the time. That's a lot of wins. And so,
is this the Greyhounds? Is that what
this
they're called?
The Greyhounds? Uh-huh. Yeah, Sioux Greyhounds up in Sault Ste. Marie. And so I was drafted mm-hmm. by the New York Rangers in the fifth round, and it happened in a season is the best way to summarize mm-hmm. that.
So the Rangers drafted you. How long did it take you to make the NHL? How'd that go?
Well, it took me just about the next season, because there was a lot of injuries. So I played as an 18-year-old. I only played one game. The way it went is John Davidson, who's now the president of the Columbus Blue Jackets, got hurt, and then his replacement got hurt. So they didn't have that big of a depth chart. So they had called me up because I was in their system. And I don't know how I was rated, but I remember walking up the stairs of the most famous arena in the world in Madison Square Garden and carrying my stuff up and hearing people, you know, that's that young 18-year-old goalie we drafted. And, you know, my name actually appeared in the transaction section of the USA Today. So that was really hot for me. But I had ironically walked into the coach's office, and that he was the coach of the Miracle on Ice team, Herb Brooks. And he didn't shake my hand. He poked me in the gut to see if I was in shape or not. So that was kind of unusual. But I said, "Hi, Mr. Brooks." And he said, "Grab your stuff, put it on, and get out there and become one of the men," is what he said to me. And I was like, I didn't even consider myself as a man at that time. But I was able to play a game shortly thereafter against the Colorado Rockies. They're now a baseball team. And we won the game 2-1. And Davidson and the other goalies were on the mend. And so they were coming back, and I got sent back to junior, so I...
No, wait. You went back. You went past that a little too quick. You were 18 years old. You played a game in Madison Square Garden, and you held the other team to one goal?
Yeah, we won 2-1. Yeah, it was against, as I mentioned, Colorado, and Chico Resch and some of my heroes were playing on the other end of the ice there, the guys that I just watched win the Stanley Cup with the New York Islanders. But, it happened quick. And it does sometimes happen in a lightning bolt for you. So you really got to gather your senses and be confident, too. So I was probably known as being a little overconfident at that time.
Now, in that period of time, in the late 70s, early 80s, the Islanders were the team in New York, right? 4 in a row. And did anyone care about the Rangers then?
Actually, they did care about the Rangers because they're an original six team. Yeah. And we probably had more fans than the Islanders, but the Islanders were, you know, taking names at that time.
Yeah, they had a dynasty going.
Right.
I used to go to games at Madison Square Garden, and I would work, and I would be in New York, and I would just find myself free in an evening, and I'd walk down there and, you know, ticket on the street corner. One week I was kind of bragging to some friends I had in town about, we're going to go see Gretzky. It was the years when Gretzky, that was after you were, I think, gone by then, but... Yeah. So I was going to be Mr. Show of these guys, the streets of New York, and I bought us, you know, 4 or 5 tickets, and we got in, we got through the first gate, and through the second gate, and through the third gate. But at the fourth gate, come with me, please. And they brought us down into the cellar and locked us in a room for the whole game because I had bought scalped tickets.
Oh, no.
So, you know, I was quite the host and quite humbled. Like, we sat, you know, underneath for – they let us up with 11 minutes to go.
And, I didn't know they did that.
Yeah, they will take you down and just sort of punish you. But with 11 minutes to go, they let us come up for standing room only. And some of my friends to this day say, I saw Gretzky for 11 minutes and it was worth it.
So, that's a story.
Yeah, yeah, the garden. So, you know, when we talk about at the intersection of faith and media, the No Shame podcast is what we're trying to find out from people who have had a chance to have an influence. And, you know, an NHL player and a good NHL player, I knew you when you walked in the door. That doesn't happen for everybody. At what point did – well, how's your testimony go? How does God enter the picture for John Van Beesbrouck?
Well, I mean, how God entered my picture was really through a tragedy. And it was from my hero, my brother Frank. You know, it's one of those situations where he slipped into a state of depression. And I had a lot of things going on in my life, so it wasn't just his tragedy. But you can, now that we have an opportunity to look backwards, you can see how God was working in you, around you, and then through you. Mm-hmm. And so, but he really got my attention through my brother taking his life in the early 90s. And the team slipping and myself being up to be traded, well, that was the number one thing. You start hearing your name in trade rumors. That's really tough. And for all those fans out there that talk trades and fantasy, you know, give your guys a little bit of a break there. But emotions were riding real high for me, so you start searching for answers like why me and things like that. And at the same time, we had a Christian on our team that asked for us to go over the house, and we watched some Dobson tapes, funny enough, about family, because I really wanted with my wife to bring up a really solid family, but we didn't really know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the around you types of illustrations. But in me, what was going on was, you know, I didn't really cry at my brother's funeral, and I didn't want to show emotion. I had none. And with that, I mean, when you become successful, you become very prideful in your own game, your own schedule. Everything's about you. And I could see that my wife was starting to resent that a bit, and we had a bit of a rift going on with three boys, very difficult. As people will know that, you know, they'll tell you, the world will tell you that when you bring up and have children, you know, that brings you closer together. And I would stop right there and say, you know, not so much. And so we had a bit of a rift going on. And then on top of that, expansion was coming into the NHL. Anaheim and Florida were the two teams. And I was then selected by Florida as the first player taken in expansion in 93. And Florida and Anaheim came in, as I said, and I was happy to go to either place because, you know, I'm a golfer. I love golf. So, I mean, you can play a lot of golf in both of those markets. So I was kind of excited. And then some events happened. One was our oldest son, Ian, at the time was five. Was supposed to be enrolled in kindergarten. My wife went down from New York to Florida ahead of me, and he wasn't accepted into kindergarten. And I was like, what kind of, you know, this is only my son that doesn't get invited into kindergarten, or our son. And they had diagnosed him with something relatively new to us. It was known, and it is known, as ADD. To some, it's known as ADHD. And I asked, what was that? And my wife explained that it was when you can't focus on something for a long period of time. And I kind of stopped and chuckled at that and said, well, that's pretty well the whole country and has that problem. So, and they wanted to right away, you know, give him some medication. And we were kind of against medicating a five-year-old. And so we had to take him somewhere. So we took him to this school called Crossroads. And it was very ironically named for what we were going on in our family had going on. And so he went to this place in South Florida that was fantastic. And but you, in order to know and understand ADD, you had to have something known as counseling. And I didn't want to be counseled. I didn't think anybody could help me. And I remembered before my brother passed, and that a doctor once said, something very significant to me because he said he couldn't help my brother. And I said, why not? And he said, because Frank doesn't want to help himself. And the, you know, something that was said to me by the counselor is, this is really going to help you help yourself. And I looked at my wife, and she had known that statement, and we had talked about it with my brother. And then subsequently to that, the team in Florida started a chapel, and I was the only attendee. So I went with this guy to Steve, with Steve to this very holy place to have a little counseling session with him, too, of places known as the IHOP, the International House of Pancakes. Mm-hmm. I said that, I told that story once, and this guy goes, oh, is that the International House of Prayer? There is such a thing.
Yeah, in Kansas City.
Gosh, I can't use that one anymore.
Yeah, it's a great place.
But it was the other spiritual place, right? Because that was when I had time, was in the morning. So Steve would ask me one question every time we met. Where's Jesus in your life, John? And I just say, yeah, you know, I mean, I'm a C&E Christian. You know, we go to church on Christmas and Easter, and I know the big fella upstairs, and use all these terminologies. And, you know, we'd meet, he'd ask the question, and at the same time, my wife, I saw her broken and meeting with a moms to moms group at this same school church that Ian, our oldest, wasn't allowed to go to. So, and she started to change. You know, she started to say, I watched the game last night. She wasn't a big sports fan, but she actually was a John fan. So she'd watched the game, and I was like, wow, what's going on here? But I met with Steve the one time, and Steve said to me, John, you know, where's Jesus in your life? And I got really indignant with him. And, you know, we're at the IHOP, and raising your voice is probably not a good thing there. And so, you know, everything came to an abrupt stop, and I kind of, in a real loud voice, says, I can hug and hold my face. I don't see Jesus around here, do you? Mm-hmm. And he just looked at me, and he was a very non-confrontational guy, and he got a little abrupt with me, and he said, you don't understand. And I just said, yeah, well, why don't you tell me? Mm-hmm. And it opened up the door, and he said, well, do you really want to help yourself? And I just went, there's that tagline of, and he just kind of opened me up, and he said, you know, you don't understand Jesus very well, do you? And I said, well, again, why don't you tell me? And he said, well, Jesus just wants to not be in a hierarchy. This isn't about the law. It's not about anything like that. It's about love. It's about sharing his love. And as he said the word share, it was like I started to feel tears come to my eyes, and my heart opened up, and I thought to myself at that time, what's going on with me? And so, you know, he said, hey, and he reached out his hand, and he said, why don't we just pray a prayer? And I, you know, two guys holding hands in IHOP to me was a very spiritual thing, but we prayed the prayer, and I looked up, and there was a woman holding a jug of coffee with tears in her eyes saying, can I pray that prayer too?
Whoa.
And I was in utter shock and of what I just did. And then all the thoughts started rushing to my head. What's going on in my life? What did I just do? And what are my teammates going to think? Am I going to be one of those guys? You know, is this going to affect my contract? Of course, I was thinking of me. And then I really turned the attention to my wife. Like, what is she going to say? Is she going to really accept this? I don't know. So I went home that night, or that day. It was still morning. I said to her, I have something to tell you. And she said, I have something to tell you, too. And I thought it was about the kids. And so we agreed that we'd put everybody to bed and sit at the side of the bed. And for anybody that has ever sat at the side of the bed with their wife and wondered what the words were going to come, that's a really, really difficult time. And so she said, you go tell me what you're going to say. And I said, no, you go. You tell me. And she said, well, I accepted the Lord Jesus Christ as my Savior today. And I just – and she looked at me like I was going to divorce her on the spot. And I said, man, I did the very same thing today.
Oh, my goodness.
And I realized at that point, and we looked at each other, and we said, only the truth and the power of a risen Christ could do that, bring two people in marriage. And I realized a really significant thing, because I really wanted to help myself, is that it was beyond me. And there was nothing I can do to make this thing happen. And ever since then, we've lived changed lives. We celebrate a different anniversary because the bond of marriage means so much more than matrimony, the covenant that we have together. We've been married 31 years, but really it's 25. And under the supervision of Jesus Christ.
You know, if you're, for whatever reason, this podcast has made it into your car or into your headphones or wherever you are, if you're listening to this conversation, I'm having a conversation with John Van Beesbroek, a hero of mine as a hockey fan and a great goaltender, and I just heard him share the same story you did, and I didn't know it coming in. This is, and I'm just struck with how God reaches into our lives at the at his point of choosing, and how this friend of yours named Steve just confronted you with that. If this podcast has any chance of reaching into the heart of whoever's listening, that same question is available to you. You know, what are you doing with Jesus? And would you be interested and open to opening your life to the creator of the universe who loves you? And as John, one of the macho NHL all-star, if Jesus can reach a guy like you, then the rest of us are definitely susceptible to being transformed by the living God. And I love how you connected it, and I love how God worked with your marriage, because I've been married 30 years. It's very similar. And I recognize what you're talking about, that I can picture that moment on the side of the bed. And since that day, you guys celebrate a new anniversary. Mm. That's available for any of you married people out there, too. It is available. The relationship that you two have, ordained by God, can be reformed and can be made like a brand new marriage with a whole new set of priorities and adventures. And I highly endorse it, and I'm thrilled to hear how. So how's your wife doing?
She's doing great. She loves life, and we have a deeper relationship with our whole family. And it's not, when you talk about marriage between two people is one thing, but when you talk about relationship to your whole family, when you pray for them, when you can hold their hand and walk with them through situations, because we know how real life is. It's not a fake life. It's not a phony. We love life because we can be authentic about it with all our mistakes and all our errors and all the things that we wish we ought not to do, as Paul appropriately states.
We don't get it perfect. And if the Apostle Paul didn't get it perfect, who himself was knocked on the ground and blinded for 3 days, we don't get it perfect. But Paul kept getting up, kept walking right out of these prisons and kept praising God even in his suffering, and has become arguably the most influential person who ever lived other than Jesus Christ himself, Apostle Paul. What a great guy.
Yeah, the illustration there with Paul, and you can take it to sports, because he talks about how you run a race and things of that nature is for pro athletes, you have to renew and remake yourself every day. Otherwise, you're out the door. Injury can happen in a moment. How do you handle that? Different types of setbacks, losing, and knowing that you're not a loser. But that's the hope of Jesus Christ is that he's with you through all of it, and he'll pick you back up. And the illustrations of Paul about not only how you run it, but how you finish. And the finish line is always drawn to eternal life. And, it's interesting how we can share our lives with people that might affect them to get to the finish line.
Hmm. You still see hockey players. Tell me about your purview these days around the rinks. What are you doing today?
I'm doing some significant things in hockey here locally in Michigan. I'm running a hockey team known as the Muskegon Lumberjacks, and it's in what's known as the USHL, which is our top tier one designation in the United States for players between 16 and 20. And 16 and 20 is probably the most influential time in an athlete's – I told you the story of my jersey and losing that was all during what's known as junior. And I've dedicated a lot of time to not only the team here, but I'm a vice president with USA Hockey, and one of my responsibilities is junior hockey throughout the United States and trying to promote it and educate people on the avenues and how to get there and what it all means and how it relates to college hockey. And, you know, there's a lot to be said about the ages of 16 to 20 and the misconceptions out there. I know that people want to give them labels like millennials and different types of things. What they are is people trying to find a way and learning from mistakes just like we did. And, you know, they just need help and hope.
And that's a big dream, and it's a difficult dream, isn't it, to make a professional sport?
It is. It's, you know, a 1 in 3,000 in the sport of hockey. For all the people that are out there listening that are applying themselves financially and selling out on that or selling out on time and commitment and stuff like that, the reality is it's 1 in 3,000.
John Van Biesbroek, your career, like we started this podcast, your career took you to the heights. You were the best goaltender in the NHL. You've made the all-star team multiple times. You've made the Hall of Fame. But any professional career doesn't last forever. What happened when you started to recognize maybe this playing career wasn't going to last forever, and how did that hit you?
Well, it hits you hard. I mean, you search because the same word applies to older people. It's called retirement. Mm-hmm. And in sports, you retire at a really young age. And I looked at it when I was 39 years old. You're a real young guy, but you're old in the sport.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder, what is the next step? And how do you lead your family? And what's the best for them? And I think that that always doesn't go together. And when you're searching for things in that way, sometimes you make quick decisions or hasty decisions. But I knew that at that time I wanted to stay in the sport. I mean, it gave me so much. I love the sport with all its, you know, issues as well. But I wanted to be a person that provided solutions. As a goalie, one of the main things that most people don't know is you're more analytical than probably the next person because you're always watching the game from a different angle.
Mm-hmm.
You get to see it coming at you mm-hmm. rather than going after it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought that was my strong suit, so I've got into that suit for most my post-NHL days.
It's an experience most of you won't have unless you're the 1 in 3,000. But it's really fascinating to hear that and even that perspective of the game coming at you. And, you know, the next time you're going to heckle the goalie and yell their name, you know, in sing-song fashion, just remember there's somebody in that mask that no shame. We sometimes throw this verse out here. I'm not ashamed of the gospel because it is God's power for salvation to everyone who believes. Do you have any thoughts or reactions to that idea of, like you even said, I wonder what my teammates will think of me. Why is there sort of a nervousness or, I would hate to say, but a shame of the gospel in our culture today? And how do you feel or deal with that?
Well, I think it's probably the biggest factor of why people struggle with sharing the gospel or inviting them to church. You know, I mean, that's probably the best place and easiest thing to do is to invite somebody to church. It's they could always say no. But I also think that we have opposition in that, and it's a great opposition towards knowing enough of the Bible to make it sound like you're relevant. And it is such a master, destructive type of approach to it where nobody's ever going to master the Bible.
Right.
The greatest of theologians can't. They can make suggestions to what's going to happen, whether it's from Revelation or any other talking about sin and things like that. You really don't. You're just talking about faith and hope, and that's a simple decision. But it still becomes a major opposition. I face it, too. I face it with people that say, I don't have any beliefs, and then you wonder, okay, what's the next step? You know, do you take them down the Romans road, or what do you really do? And I think the number one thing is just loving them, you know, mm-hmm. showing them that you care. Mm-hmm. And it's a more without words than it is with, yeah. you know, because that's the greatest defense that you can give, I believe, is to put a safety zone around what you say. Mm-hmm. You know, you really have to put it's what comes out of your mouth that causes more harm than what stays inside. Mm-hmm. And so the shame part of it is that I believe that Satan is the master of shame, and that's, you know, when Eve was deceived, it's comes right out of there where she was deceived. And you know, what did it cause them? They were naked, right? And then they had to put on the leaves or whatever they wore because of shame. Mm-hmm. And I think that nobody likes to feel shame. And I can go on and on about my own positions on things, but really, where does that really get you? Hmm. You know, I have a saying that I've adopted. Where does it get to you? Where does it get you really when you're right? Hmm. Does it solve the problem? Hmm. I mean, where does right really get you? Hmm. It's best to be known as truthful, and the truth comes from knowing God's word and sharing it with other people.
Well, that sounds kind of like a high-level theology to me, loving somebody. It boils down pretty simple, but if you don't care about him, you're kind of missing the foundation of what the gospel is in us too. Someone asked Jesus, all right, take all those writings, take all those scrolls, take everything you've taught, can you boil it down for me for one thing? And he said, yeah, I can do that. Love the Lord your God and love your neighbor as yourself. Mm-hmm. We can remember that much.
And that's the greatest illustration we have in mankind. There's no greater love than this, right, than one who would lay down his life for another. I mean, that's sports too. And just to bring it back to that for a second is to say, you know, how would Jesus be as a coach? Hmm. Would he have to curse and swear, or would he just turn to you and say that I love you, brother? And I think that those two sides of the coin are the things that we really need to look at when we get so intense, when we have to have it our way, is to look at it through those two prisms. Do you really need to be right and dogmatic, or do you really just need to love someone and say, you know what, I understand you and I love you, and it's as simple as that.
Hmm. John Van Biesbroek with us on the No Shame podcast. It's a lot easier to just be right all the time than actually care about people. Thank you so much for joining us. It's just been a pleasure. The Muskegon Lumberjacks, we can go watch them at LC Walk Arena. Is that right?
Please come out.
Absolutely. Go see the Muskegon Lumberjacks and don't heckle the goaltenders. Thank you. Have no shame.